This next symposium for the next 2 hours is entitled Dying with Dignity in Jewish Law. I just want to give a little preface to this next session in that Torah in Motion has always prided itself, and this conference in particular, on dealing with some of the more controversial issues. For those of you that are past participants, you know that we've dealt with some of the more difficult issues as they came up. In the context and the spirit of intellectual dialogue, respect for opinion, and I think that with that introduction, I want to sort of set the tone for this morning. This morning we have three speakers that are going to be discussing this, and we will also have an opportunity for panel discussion. Our experience is that this area is one that people feel very strongly about, they feel passionate about. It may be something that has involved an individual in your family. It may be something that people are unfortunately going through. And sometimes the black and white in vacuum halakha seems to be something which leaves something to be desired in the sense that not everybody would necessarily feel comfortable with that. The reason I'm saying this is that I would like very much that this becomes a discussion which we understand, we hear the points that are to be made. There will be differences of opinion, and I think it's most important that we understand that there needs to be some respect, and I don't expect that there's going to be any sort of, but I do want to preface it with the understanding that in an opinion where you may not agree, there is room to understand and hear where that individual is coming from. So without making more of the issue than there is, but I just wanted that as a baseline to understand where we're coming from. Our speakers today, and they're going to do a presentation in tandem, is Dr. Brian Berger and Dr. Jonathan Abrams, and the next session will be with Rabbi Dr. Steinberg. Now, Dr. Brian Berger and Dr. Jonathan Abrams are both palliative care physicians. They're from Toronto. I have the privilege of knowing Brian for well over 20 years since we've been working together at our hospital in Richmond Hill, Ontario. And I just wanted to share with you a minor anecdote. We both are physician leads in our hospital in different capacities. I struggle always with trying to bring up our patient satisfaction, and I turn to Brian for advice, and I say, your patients are dying, and you have 99% patient satisfaction. How do you do that? I'm struggling with that. Brian is a palliative care physician, and he has been physician lead in many different aspects of our hospital. Above all, even among the non-Jews in our hospital, he's known as a mensch. So are you guys doing this? Back to back. So I do also want to introduce Dr. Jonathan Abrams, who is a palliative care physician at Mount Sinai Hospital. Very passionate physician in his work in the end of life palliative care. But also on a very personal note, he's been very helpful to us in terms of the committee when we look at the organization of the project. And the program, he's been extremely helpful sitting and helping us with this committee. So I thank you both for your participation prior to coming. And Dr. Berger, you have the floor, and we'll start with palliative care and Jewish halakha.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much for the introduction, and welcome everybody. Thank you for being here, and a special thank you to the organizers for including this very important topic as part of the conference, and as you'll gather along the route, there's some very controversial issues that do come about. But I think Jonathan and I are going to try our best to sort of set the ground in terms of palliative care in general, not perhaps related to Jewish ethics, etc., but mainly setting the ground and introducing a patient that I was very intimately involved with, which had quite an impact on me and which I sent through to various members of the medical community and some close friends of mine to share an experience that I've gone through, which I think is going to probably hopefully take precedence in terms of patient discussion, because I think a lot can evolve from that. So my section of the talk is going to be basically being a witness to the end of life journey, special moments in time and caring. And as I say, this patient is quite important in it, and I'm going to present the patient for sure. But I thought before I do that, I should just ground where I'm coming from before obviously just throwing in and having this patient presented to you. So the first question that a lot of people ask me is, you know, you're a palliative care physician, what really is the work that you do? So my work, I am a family physician, so I do have a regular family practice, but a good 30 to 40% of my practice time is occupied by caring for people with a very end-of-life prognosis. These may be people with cancer, as we often expect, but also maybe a variety of other issues as well. People with end-stage dementia, massive strokes, end-stage renal failure, end-stage respiratory failure, cardiac failure, and more over time, these other kind of patients, non-cancer patients, have become very much part of our focus. And in fact, our palliative care unit, which I run, which is a 15-bed unit in our institution, many times, certainly more than 50% of the patients have a non-cancer diagnosis. So this is really a very big switch around from what palliative care used to be when I started this around 15 to 20 years ago. We started doing this kind of practice 15 to 20 years ago. And a lot of it is because many of the different facets of medical specialists have come to me also within our hospital and said, like, what can we do to improve not only our satisfaction, but improve end-of-life discussions maybe early on in the trajectory of people's illness. We have a massive dialysis unit, for example, in our institution, and end-of-life discussions weren't even on the agenda when we started the dialysis program. So people would have dialysis, and clearly they were very ill in general, and no discussions had been held in terms of what their wishes were, etc., until things were really almost too late, like they couldn't discuss it further, which led to a lot of family dynamic issues as well. The second question is, how do I do this work? So, you know, obviously this is a lot of life balancing sort of thing. I have to work in an office, I have to work in a hospital, I have to work in the community, etc. And time management is critical, but, you know, my philosophy always is if you do your best for your patient and give them the best quality of your time that you can give them, that will go a long way in terms of their own comfort and in terms of the family appreciating what you're doing as well. To do this work, also, I cannot do it alone and in isolation. So, fortunately, I have a fantastic amount of people that I work with. These are nurses at our hospital, volunteers, a complementary therapist in our units, paramedical personnel, etc., and chaplaincy staff that we heavily rely on for support. And if I didn't work in such a wonderful team, I think it would be extremely difficult to do this kind of work. And of course, the largest question and the most difficult one is, why do I do this kind of work? I've always been the kind of person who sees the vulnerable people in our society, the people sort of pushed aside, as people I may be attracted to see what I can do to help them. Certainly when I started this kind of work, patients who were at the end of their life may have been pushed aside a little bit more than I liked. In terms of the medical community, they were almost seen as to be failures, and doctors had a general discomfort with caring for people like this. Like, these were the people, this is not what we were meant to do. We were meant to save lives, and this is not what we meant to do. And these people were very isolated, and death and dying became a painful, isolating kind of experience. People already had been very disempowered, especially with difficult cancer diagnosis and being in big cancer centers. So this was the last straw in their disempowerment. So I tried to turn that around, and working with a team and working with a lot of physicians that have a similar philosophy has made this work not only interesting, it's been very rewarding as well for me. So having said that, and having given that introduction, I'm going to read you something that I wrote after being involved in a very brief time caring for a patient in our intensive care unit. And I was so emotionally overwhelmed after caring for this patient that I wrote the synopsis afterwards that I don't think 2 or 3 or 4 days later you would appreciate I would be able to write. So I'm going to read it to you. Today I was a witness to a special moment in time. Today I was witness to a special moment in time. It's 24th July 2012. Many of my physician colleagues may complain about our day-to-day working lives, the problems with our healthcare system, the demands of our patients, the lack of collegiality. I was privileged to be asked by an ICU physician to see an ALS patient, a 51-year-old man married with three children. He was an IT man with a fantastic athletic ability. He had a rapidly progressive disease process. In 18 months, he was quadriplegic, tube-fed, and on intermittent BiPAP. Now in respiratory distress, he was on full-time BiPAP, and it was enough for him. He begged for an end with comfort and dignity without that mask. All his three siblings had flown in from South Africa, UK, and Israel to be with him, as did his wife's mom and sisters from Vancouver and Israel. At 12:50 p.m., we gave him midazolam 5 milligrams and dilaudid 2 milligrams subcutaneous, and 10 minutes later, removed the mask and monitor. The ICU doc and myself shared with the whole family a 70-minute end-of-life journey where the disease finally took his life. He was peaceful, comfortable, free of agitational pain. His last words were, "I love my family." Last night, he said goodbye to his children. The ICU doctor gave the youngest child a piece of the EKG monitor strip decorated with stickers to keep a memento of a dad's heart. As his wife lay beside him with her head on his chest, the family engulfed him with their love. At the moment there was any twinge of distress, we gave him a little more medication and he slipped back into comfort. The miracle was the end-of-life journey of love, compassion, and deep caring. And I got to thinking how fortunate I am to bear witness to this moment, to accompany families on this journey, to love, to care, and to practice palliative care in its true form. I'm sad, I'm exhausted, I'm emotionally drained, but I am the privileged one, as I was witness to a special moment in time. Dr. Brian Berger. Obviously this had a tremendous emotional impact on me, sometimes within the life of medical care, I wonder, doing a lot of this work, how we came from this kind of a picture, which, as you can see, is something from the early 20th century, late 19th century artwork, where you see dying as this kind of process. Family surrounding loved ones, a doctor at the head of the bed, perhaps a nursing sister or something caring for the person, and family waiting, grieving appropriately, but being there for the individual. This is dying as people knew it for centuries. Dying up until the mid 20th century. But yet, when you ask most people how they look at death and dying now, this is what they think of. Somebody has to be in a kind of an ICU setting. There has to be a monitor around. There has to be a tracheostomy or ventilator or one of those things. There has to be an IV running. And there's a lot that we've accomplished in medicine, obviously judging from the one picture to the other, in terms of helping various situations, such as myocardial infarction, etc., etc. But for somebody who would be on an inevitable path of dying, is not the early 20th century painting perhaps the more appropriate message for dying? Because our task at hand really I see as a medical community is finding the middle ground, which is not an easy task now in the 21st century when we have so much development and so much happening to basically chase away death and dying. So what do I see as the key components missing in caring in medical work? And I see this at any given moment in many consultations that I do on the medical floor and at home. The first thing is the art of caring. Somewhere along the line, in the changeover from that picture that I first showed to this picture that I showed secondly, is the art of caring has been lost. When I phone a nurse, perhaps in an ICU or a medical ward, to ask how my patient is doing, it's the pulse is, the blood pressure is, the temperature is, etc. When I phone them in our palliative unit, and I've tried to train a lot of the staff for that, it is so-and-so is comfortable, they're free of pain, their family's around them. Somewhere along the line, we have to also get a feel about, as a caring individual, what that person is feeling like. The second thing is the compassion in caring. You know, many times when you watch movies and you see a doctor giving information to patients or their families about a devastating diagnosis, it's like with this blank face with a lot of certificates on the wall, instead of really providing the compassion to that individual. And that goes broadly along every aspect of medical care along the routes. I remember being at a patient in our palliative care unit once on a weekend call, and the nurse said to me, the sister of this woman who was dying was having a hard time understanding how the medications may work for secretions, etc. So I went in, I put my hand on the patient's shoulder, assessed the situation, and then explained to the sister what the process was that was happening. And she said to me, and I said to her, do you understand that? And her answer to me was, I didn't hear a word that you said, which made me feel a bit, obviously, upset. And I said to her, I'm sorry, should I explain it differently? She says, no, but it doesn't matter what you said, because I saw the way you looked at my sister and held her shoulder, and I knew she was being cared for. So in a real way, families do see that as important. And sensitive communication remains an extremely important aspect of care. I give a lot of lectures to different physicians, nursing staff, volunteers, etc., on how really to go to the bedside, sit next to somebody, really listen to them, and the time that you're spending with them, make it sensitive and make it meaningful. And the importance of comfort in caring, because we may, for example, order a morphine-type injection or opioid every 4 hours, etc. But when you come in, that's a time that you can share with somebody. That's a moment of caring. And the importance of comfort in that moment is extremely important. The value of a person's life story in caring as well, because without knowing who that individual is, how can you really care for them? So one of the first aspects in my history of somebody is, who is that person? What did they grow up at? What was their family like? What was their life like? What was their meaning like? Because to treat somebody at that end stage colon cancer in bed 132 is clearly inappropriate, but clearly something that we as physicians often get into. And I remember phoning up a family member on a very difficult patient on our medical floor when I got a consultation, and I sat next to an internist, and they said, this family was so difficult to deal with, good luck. And I assessed the patient was very terminal, and I phoned the family. I said, my name's Dr. Berger, I'm a palliative care physician, I've come to see your dad. Before I go into the medical stuff, let me find out a little bit about him. What's his religious background? Where did he grow up? What kind of work did he do? Etc. The social history that sometimes you push aside. And then when I mentioned that I'd seen him and he seemed uncomfortable and we wanted to keep him comfortable, the family said that was fine. And I put on the phone and the internist looked at me and said, I learned so much from that discussion, because those are the questions we didn't ask. Because straight away they picked up the phone and said, this is the situation, and this is what happens. And obviously, to do this kind of work without installing any hope is obviously inappropriate as well. But as you'll see, what we're really hoping for is hope for comfort and hope for a peaceful end, as opposed to losing all hope. So William Osler put it best: the person who has a disease is more important than the disease a person has. Because as caregivers too often, we underestimate the power of a touch, a smile, a kind word, a listening ear, an honest compliment, or the smallest act of caring, all of which have the potential to turn a life around. It's overwhelming to consider the continuous opportunities there are to make our love felt. So what then is palliative care? Well, this is a World Health Organization definition. It's an approach that improves the quality of life of patients and their families facing the problem associated with life-threatening illness through prevention and relief of suffering by means of early identification and impeccable assessment and treatment of pain and other problems, be they physical, psychosocial, and spiritual. So looking at it this way, suffering occurs. Suffering occurs in many, many illnesses. But basically, suffering has various components in it, all that interrelate and contribute to the suffering. And of course, we have to know our drugs to care for the patients, and that's the physical aspect, and more than drugs as well. But the psychosocial, emotional, and yes, spiritual components all have an impact, and all can have a negative and a positive connotation in the treatment of that very individual. So in the old model of palliative care, what we used to say when somebody becomes palliative, we had an active treatment model, managing a cancer, a heart disease, whatever. Then we have a palliative system or service, and then we have death. But the new model of palliative care is basically from the minute you have a diagnosis in a potential life-threatening situation, start off at the beginning introducing the concept of how important comfort is, and gradually as time progresses, the cure or life-prolonging intent becomes less important and the palliative comfort intent becomes more important. This is how best to work together, to work as a team, and not for patients and their families to see palliative as we've given up on active treatment as it is in the top box. And then we look at death, and then we look at bereavements being more involved initially, especially right at the initial time of death, and slowly moving away from that model. Interestingly enough, this is also borne out in the literature. There's a landmark article many of you may know in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2010 by Jennifer Temel et al. And it was an article that turned everything on its head. It's something that we as palliative care physicians have been speaking about for a long time, and basically showed proof with thousands of patients documented that people with advanced lung cancer who were randomly chosen, those who were treated with early outpatient palliative care lived longer than patients randomized to the usual care. So getting a palliative care consult early did not negatively impact on their prognosis, and in fact positively influenced their prognosis. And this is the whole model, once again, of disease-focused care, comfort-focused care, coming together, then moving to death, then moving to follow-up, all under the umbrella of providing excellent psychosocial and spiritual support. Just a few words about hope. So basically what we do in palliative care is encourage a shift from hope for life and hope to get better to hope for some time together and hope for a peaceful death. But whatever we do, we know we cannot shatter hope, because we really are hoping for a patient's physical comfort, their emotional calm, and then a peaceful death. So within palliative care, as Jonathan's also going to allude to, there's a lot of issues that occur in this process. There's treatment decisions, and sometimes this is how I feel. Would you prefer the rock or the hard place? Food and fluids are enormous ethical issues at the end of life, and we can discuss that at any given time in our panel discussion. Withdrawing or withholding treatments, some people see as euthanasia. How can you not feed my loved one? That means you're killing them. How can you not put up an intravenous? Because that should be, everybody should have an intravenous, and death and dying is happening. Even if somebody's ballooning full of fluids, they still feel that an intravenous needs to be given. If you're sedating somebody, is this not a form of euthanasia? Yes, they do appear much more comfortable than they did, but you're using the morphine and they're much more sedated, and aren't you really killing them in this process? Then you have the other extreme, is you wouldn't let an animal die this way. People often will say this to me, everyone would be better off if I'll just die. Because you know, for a lot of people at the end of life, for more people who are anxious about not having appropriate pain management, they're more anxious about causing discomfort to those around them. And how long have I got? And how will I die? So, just in summary, this is sometimes how I see myself in the process, as being that person at the doorway, desperately being held out by some of the staff, because every single physician, nurse, etc., is trying their best to keep somebody alive at all costs. And there's this guy coming, dressed in black like I am often doing, and ready to come in and provide a whole different focus of calling the palliative code, as I like to call it. Thank you.
So, good morning, good afternoon. Thank you for having me here. Hope everyone's enjoying the conference so far. My name is Jonathan Abrams. I work as a home care physician, seeing only home-based palliative care patients. As well as Dr. Berger says, patients mostly with cancer, but also end-stage, heart, lung disease, neurological problems. And we also have a pediatric program that we do with sick kids, and we're seeing children. Most of them that I've had have been with brain tumors, but also other illnesses that we care for at home. The university that we're affiliated with, University of Toronto, requires us to have a disclosure statement. So other than being one of my Tomlin's brother-in-law and being roped into this, as Jay knows how much I love public speaking, I don't have a vested interest other than being an active physician who is caring for patients who are palliative. So I don't know if you can see this joke, but coming both after Dr. Berger, who is highly respected, and Rabbi Steinberg, you know, maybe I should have gone first. So how I see my role in the work that I do, trying to bring comfort to both patient and family and caregivers, and very similar to what Dr. Berger said. Trying to provide quality over quantity of life, easing things for today with less emphasis on tomorrow. And when we talk about hope, family think you're the bad guy, and yes, I can't bring them a cure. And I'm actually quite direct with the families about this. That's not my role, and I can't provide it. If they want that from me, they're going to be very disappointed. But I can provide other things, and when they see that, they, I think, really can appreciate what we offer. So one of the things we provide, or try and hope we can give people, is death with dignity, and that doesn't just include what we wear and how we come and take care of them. And you know you're in trouble when I start getting comments from certain streets. Oh, we saw your car on their driveway. That must mean he's really sick. You know, people start recognizing you. You get a reputation. They know what you're there for. And that, it's interesting to note how people react to us. What I provide is home-based palliative care. That's very different to hospital care. And I think one of the key points that Dr. Berger pointed out is that transition from active care in a chemo clinic to palliative care. How that's done colors how people can accept palliative care. When an oncologist kind of just says, well, now you're going to get a doctor at home, but doesn't introduce what it's all about, that family is angry, is upset, doesn't know how to handle it. Versus an oncologist who says, look, I'm here, this is a different part of your care, they will provide other essential things to you that we can't do. We can see you if we need to, because there are occasions when we have to send patients to hospital. The care actually transitions much better and works better for the family. It's within a home care setting, and that comes with all the benefits and the negatives, from homes that are not clean, to bed bugs, to cockroaches, and everything in between, to people who insist on living alone in squalor. I have a patient right now who's living in a trailer behind a factory with no water. You'd never think this existed in Toronto, about 5 minutes from where I live. He insists on living there, wants to live there. He's made it quite beautiful. He has a girlfriend. And it's, you know, on one hand, I respect him. On the other hand, it's not any way I would want to live. But we're providing care to him in his home. There's less interaction with high-tech machines, such as in a hospital ICU. I have one patient on a ventilator right now. And to be honest, as a criteria, our service would not normally take a patient who has ALS with a ventilator. That prognosis is much longer. That is not the type of patient we take. We take patients with a prognosis of less than a year. They live 2 years, we still keep them. But a prognosis like that is not typical. And so our patients are getting a much more holistic kind of mode of care. So it's very different to what you would see in a hospital, as I said. I'm getting tied up between the two. Okay, so a palliative home care plan would often look at one of the first things I face with a family would be disclosure. You know you're in trouble when the family rushes you at the door and says, don't tell them, they don't know what they have, and how you handle that. And that can be very, very difficult. It's probably one of my biggest stressors in the work we do. Families who say, well, mom knows she has a problem with her blood. She doesn't know she has multiple myeloma. She doesn't know that she could die of it. We don't want to tell her. Yet they ask mom where she wants to be. Mom says she wants to stay home. My thing is that's not fair to ask the patient. You can't ask the patient, do you want to be home? The patient gets sicker, do you want to go to hospital? When they don't really know what they're deciding about. They don't have full informed consent. And families are doing it with the best of intentions. They say, we know the patient, we're trying to protect them. They'll give up, they'll die much sooner. We've seen cases where patients are finally told, and there's a sense of relief, where they knew it all along, but now someone's actually being honest with them, and they don't have that same fear anymore. So we really try and push for disclosure, or at least ask the person if they want to know. Do they want to know what's going on? Do they have any questions? And I will promise the patient I won't lie to them. If they want information, I'll give it to them. But if they also say no, talk to my child, my son, my brother, we also try and respect that. Trying to determine the goals of care, what they're looking for, trying to plan. We often say this is like insurance. The more we can talk about today, the easier it will be for your children to know what you want or don't want, so they can respect your wishes and make decisions without all the guilt of deciding and then feeling you would have wanted something else. It's not a criteria to be on our service to agree to no resuscitation. People can be at home and ask to be resuscitated and call 911. However, if they go into a palliative care unit, the palliative care units have that as a requirement. Even Baycrest, which is the Jewish Geriatric Center, has a palliative care unit. They will not accept someone if they want resuscitation. You cannot go in there. And their feeling is that we can't support that. We can't offer the resuscitation to the patients. We don't have the staff. And it's kind of against their philosophy of comfort care. And so that is a criteria, and we can't even apply. They won't look at an application for a patient without that being completed. Some of the more pressing issues, stopping refusing chemo radiation is probably a big deal. Patients and families have a hard time realizing that less is actually more, that doing this aggressive care will probably kill their family faster and sooner. We often see in that study, and Dr. Berger talked about it, is patients live longer with good palliative care. When someone's paying attention to their bed sores, paying attention to their comfort, they live longer. Families think that as soon as they let go of that aggressive care, the patient is going to die. And really, that's not what we see. I mean, I've had patients at home, I'm sure if they were in hospital, I had a woman recently who did die after about two years in our service. I think she had urothelial cancer for about 8 years. She died for over 6 months. She had a hemoglobin of less than 50. I assume in the States that's 5, less than 5. She refused a transfusion. We offered it to her. And she lived at home where she wanted and died at home where she wanted. Had this woman been in hospital, I'm certain she would have died faster. Antibiotics, oral and IV. We can do oral antibiotics at home. What do you do about IV? Home care is, we work a lot with home care in Toronto, and we can get IV antibiotics. It's a bit trickier to get a first dose at home. I will usually encourage families to go to hospital. If they're looking for that level of care, then I don't feel it's consistent with a home palliative situation, usually. Insertion of feeding tubes, when a person can't eat or things are so advanced. I think in my 10 years of doing this in Toronto, there's been 3 or 4 cases where I've encouraged the family to go for a feeding tube. Often it's, one case I can think of was a woman with a gastric tumor who really was well but starting to decline, and without a feeding tube, I could see her starving. Most of my patients are going through a slow trajectory where they have the cachexia, they're not tolerating food, they can't eat food, and I encourage them to support that, small frequent meals, to encourage liquids, other things by mouth, but I would rarely push for a feeding tube. I don't think it really prolongs life. And it creates a lot more complication. Hydration, I've kind of personally, this is my personal feel, I do think it probably can prolong life, but I also think it can cause more problems. And most patients that I encounter, although most of them are not Jewish, they are not looking to prolong when they see their family member dying. If a family will ask me for hydration, I will do it, often subcutaneously, which is a slower form under the skin, with the caveat that if they get congested, if they get edema, we begin to try and stop it if it's uncomfortable for the person. And then sedation, and I'm going to talk about a few articles about that. The guiding principles probably are to do no harm, relieve suffering, recognizing at the same time that existential suffering often are much harder problems to treat than the physical pain. And I think that's probably where we lack as physicians in trying to treat that part of suffering for patients and families. That existential stress where people are really suffering with being a burden to others, being a burden to themselves, not wanting to witness what is going to happen. So the issue comes up about terminal sedation. Often I think in the studies talk about this, late in the dying process it's easier to deal with rather than early on, when the dying process has already started. We used to believe, within palliative care even, that good palliative care could relieve all suffering. That's not true. I don't think it's true. I think some people do have a horrible death. I can't explain it. We do our best not to, and most people don't. This reminds me, I actually had a case right now. About 2 months ago, it was a young woman. She was Jewish, late 50s, single, no children, with uterine cancer. she was really struggling with her illness and had made up her mind before we got there, she's going to Switzerland to have herself killed. She did not want to see me because she heard I was religious. She thought I would talk her out of it. She says, I know what's going to happen. I was told you die writhing on the floor in a palliative care unit. I don't want that. I don't want strangers looking after me. I have no family. I'm going. The end of the story, she did go to Switzerland. She asked to meet another one of our physicians who was Jewish, not religious. He worked with her, tried to show her what good palliative care could be, provided her with a lot of symptom relief, and she went to Switzerland and killed herself. Her obituary was in the paper. She came back to Toronto, and one of the things she was worried about is, would they bury me next to my father in the Jewish cemetery? She did not. She refused for us that. That was her pressing issue. So as a palliative care physician, that was an issue I wanted to address. I tried to offer her to meet with the chaplain. She refused, but anonymously I asked, and they said they wouldn't ask questions, and they would just do it. And I believe she was buried, according to her wishes. I think we can make a difference. We may not eliminate all suffering. I think palliative care is actually a return to what medicine is all about, some of the core fundamentals of medicine. And I think, you know, providing a good death for patients is really what we try and do. And one of the biggest treatments I would say we provide is our presence. Yes, we have the drugs, we have the opioids, and we have sedatives, and we have other drugs, but often, you know, you walk in, and what did I actually do? And sometimes it's being there. Your presence, you're being in that same space with the family or the patient. Physician-assisted suicide is actually, I think, the next wave that's coming, at least in Canada and some parts of the U.S., versus relief of suffering. We are getting more and more patients asking for this. The question is how many that ask really would do it. And I think the laws are changing. Canada just presented a bill, 52 in Quebec, and they expect that it likely will pass to allow physician-assisted suicide. And you know, I think in some ways you can argue my patient who went to Switzerland probably killed herself sooner than if she had been able to have that assurance it would happen at home. She had to be able to travel, she had to be able to get on a flight, get there, and she did not want to miss that opportunity. We told her she has a window to go. She misses it, she's not going. The airline won't take her. You know, I hope in the panel we'll discuss this from a halakhic point of view, but as a physician, I have legal responsibilities, I have the responsibility to the patient. We called the college, she was asking us to fill in forms, for air travel. Am I assisting her suicide if I do that? Halakhically, legally, would that be a problem? I know where she's going. I know why she's going. The college told me when I asked, although they've given different answers to people, was we are not allowed to send her records to Switzerland. We're allowed to give her her records. She can do with them what she likes. And there's no problem filling in a travel form. They said, you know, she could be going on a trip. But these are issues that I think we as physicians are going to grapple with, are going to get asked this. And then you have an obligation to the patient not to abandon them. She's looking at you for help, for support. Sorry, I can't do that. That's out of the question. I'll go to jail. Doesn't cut it for a patient who's struggling with their death. The Healthcare Consent Act in Canada in 1994 allows withdrawal or withholding of care if the person is able to consent and appreciate the decision, where the disease state is going to lead to death, versus physician-assisted suicide, which is an act that directly leads to death in the page for the patient, which is illegal currently in Canada. You know, the challenge of the patient Dr. Berger had, was sedation appropriate? Does that differ from euthanasia? Would it be different? What is my obligation as a physician, as someone who I tell my patients I'm their doctor, I'm not their rabbi. You know, I didn't bring it up before, but one issue that I have as a physician is, what if I know a Jewish patient's going to be cremated? You know, I spoke to one rabbi, he said, oh, you have to talk them out of it. I personally don't get involved with that. Maybe it's the wrong thing, but I don't see that as my role. I can point them to someone who can. What is my obligation to the patient, the family, and their religious beliefs themselves. The landmark article in the American Medical Association Archives of Internal Medicine in 2003, people often point to the issue of double effect when looking at sedation or giving opioids. Families talk about this, you know, you're going to kill the patient. And they actually show that giving sedatives and sedative dose increase in last hours of life were not associated with shortened survival overall. And that really was suggesting that the doctrine of double effect, which makes people very afraid of using the drugs, is rarely has to be involved as to excuse sedating drugs in the end stage of life. The study went so far as to conclude that invoking this concept is irrelevant. It perpetuates the myth that satisfactory symptom control at the end of life is associated with hastening death. And this is often cited as a common reason for and a reluctance for giving adequate comfort. And it's not, you know, it's not something that we can rely on. And, you know, I was uncomfortable personally with using that doctrine as allowing it, but, you know, of giving the drugs. Another article in Annals of Oncology in 2009, this was a prospective multi-center trial, showed that sedation does not shorten life when used to relieve refractory symptoms, and does not need the doctrine of double effect to justify use of this from an ethical point of view. And I think although the studies are reinforcing that the sedation end of life doesn't hasten death, in truth, these are very difficult studies to do. They're not objective, randomized, double-blind studies. It's very hard to do that ethically to a patient population. They're more retrospective and descriptive and on a select group of patients. And I guess people can come back and argue that one way or another about legitimacy. But I think they are showing something that is quite valid. And sedation in response to a dying process that has already begun can be provided, safe, you know, in a responsible manner. If you give excessive doses, sure, you can kill a patient. But it's very, I've seen patients, you think they're going to die. Sometimes people don't die as quickly as you think. And it can be done safely and effectively in the right manner. So as a South African, I think I don't know if people are watching the news, just looking at Nelson Mandela and what's going on there now with him, I just saw CNN, they said he was actively dying, they put him on life support, now they put him on dialysis. I'm not sure I would agree with this. I wonder whether he ever had that discussion before, and whether, you know, that's really the right thing to be doing.
Just to sort of highlight on that patient that I mentioned earlier, the ALS patient who I sat with for the 70 minutes, my intuition would have been that withdrawing the BiPAP, giving him hydromorphone and midazolam, I would have been looking at death very quickly. That would be my feeling, my gut feeling. But yet, witnessing that 70 minutes of recurrent uses of hydromorphone and midazolam, with total comfort, surrounded by his family, with a wife having her head lying on his chest for the first time in a year without a mask, and with the family singing around him and telling him how much they loved him, all together, a 70-minute process was beyond my wildest expectations. But I think for me, reinforced how comfort management actually does not necessarily shorten life. And, you know, that put that myth sort of really to rest for me. So, basically, a good concept to go by sort of greets me every morning when I come to our palliative care units at our hospital, and it hangs sort of proudly above the entrance to our units. And this is, listen to me, comfort me, care for me, and then remember me. These are our contact addresses, which we'll share with everybody. And just a reminder, that was a patient, and we're going to hopefully refocus on him a little bit later if some discussion evolves around that with the rabbi as well. Thank you for your time. Yeah, and I think we especially left that out because obviously an esteemed rabbi was going to speak here, so if it's, we knew it was going to come up in the panel discussion.
So you know what, maybe can we hold it?
Yeah.
I have this slide up,
that's
so
correct.
Let's just keep it.
Sorry, so, I would love to be involved. I would love to talk about it as well.
Okay, so I'm just going to ask Rabbi Steinberg to address this as well. I just again want to first of all thank Dr. Berger and Dr. Abrams for the presentation. We're going to move now to Rabbi Steinberg's talk. Keep in mind the case presentation, the parts of it of the entire sequence, you know, prior to the 70 minutes, and just to note that we gave this case to Rabbi Steinberg in order for him to be able to have it as well, so he can prepare his discussion around that. We'll do that for about 30 or 35 minutes, and then after that, we will open this up for a panel discussion, which I'm sure will generate much more discussion. Rabbi Steinberg.
Before talking about the substance that I was prepared, just a few, three or four vignettes about ALS and end of life. ALS patients differ from one another in a very wide range from literature as well as from experience that we have. Some of them want to live longer, want to do everything to them because their mind, as opposed to demented people or other end-of-life situations, their mind is totally alert and free, and they can think and they can produce. They are locked in, but mentally they are in a very good shape. So we have one case in Jerusalem, happened to be a friend of mine who about 15 or 16 years ago was diagnosed as having ALS. I am a pediatric neurologist, so I referred him to my colleague who is an adult neurologist who diagnosed him as ALS. And he told him, you know, that is a fatal disease. Within a few months, you'll deteriorate. You'll need a respirator. Take my advice. Now that you can make decisions, tell everyone you don't want any major intervention once you come to this stage. He consulted with many people, with me and others, and he made his decision that he wants further treatment and every treatment possible to prolong life, even if he reaches this final stage. He is now 15 years after the diagnosis. I'll describe him to you in a minute so you'll understand his set of mind. His physician died half a year later before he died. So you see that advice on how to to care at end of life is very, very complicated, and sometimes you think you are the healthy one, and you tell your patient, for you it's better to die at the end to die. He is totally bedridden with a trach, with a peg. He can only move his eyes. That's his only movement that he has. He has a device on his computer that he can write and correspond with his eye movements. He has written in this way over 10 books by now, full-fledged books with really very deep insights. He has written poetry, and what is even more amazing, he draws. And his pictures are sold as real good pictures, all with his movements of his eyes. Interestingly, most of his drawings are eyes, because that is really his only function that he can communicate with. So he communicates very well with his wife, with his children. Everyone comes, helps out. He has a full life, although he can't move. And not only does he feel fulfilled in his life, he goes and preaches that people should cling to life as long as their mind is functioning, because they can make out of life much more than they would have thought otherwise. So I'm not saying that every ALS patient is the same, but here you see an example, really a unique example, but of a different kind. The second story was mentioned last night by Dr. Eli Reichman, Rabbi Rafael Shmulevitz, the Miller Rosh Yeshiva, who has ALS, who is now in an experimental treatment of stem cell research that is being introduced into him with marvelous results. So just a year ago, there was no hope for ALS patient. And today, at least on an experimental level, there is hope. So if he would have decided a year ago that he doesn't want to live, he wouldn't have even the chance to live this extra year, where he was already wheelchair bound, he was intubated, he was extubated now, he was giving shiurim and meal, and he came back to a certain level of life, although he is declining and he needs repeated stem cell injections. But at least he wants to live, because he has a purpose to live, and there are remedies. Now, I'm not suggesting that every dying patient should be treated to the end degree, because maybe a remedy will be found and he'll miss the chance. We don't operate in such a way, neither medically nor halakhically. We operate as what we see. But what we already see, ALS, the example that we are discussing, may have a different future in the near future. So that is something to take into account. Third story, when in the Netherlands they decided to go for active euthanasia when it was still illegal. Now they legalized it, but for many years it was done in an illegal fashion. The physician who killed a patient, who euthanized, that's a nicer word to say, who euthanized his patients, would go to the police and say, I killed a patient. He would be fined by, I don't know what the currency is there, a drachma or whatever, a dollar, and he goes on to the next case. I remember a discussion in the early days of euthanasia in Holland, where a physician told the audience, we had a debate on this issue, he told the audience that the first time was terrible for him to do it. The second time was a little easier. By now, it's very easy for him. He thinks he does the right thing, and he does it, and he got used to the idea that he is killing people for their benefit, from his perspective, but it became easy. So I think that what we have here about care, about passion, should be taken into account and not go into routine. Letting people die is the right thing to do always and in all circumstances, because once we get used to it, we don't know where we'll end up. And finally, another story before I start what I wanted to say. I'll tell a little bit about it in a minute, but I was appointed to be the chair of a national committee to enact legislation on the dying patient in Israel in the year 2000. was a large committee. Maybe if time permits, I'll tell a little bit about it. But finally, we made certain recommendations, and it became subsequently the law of the land. One of the recommendations, which are now the law of Israel, is that there is a distinction between withdrawing and withholding, contrary to the United States, and I hear Canada the same. Now, I don't know if you know, but Israel considers itself the 51st state of the United States, and whatever is good here, right away, should be transferred into Israel. I think there are different cultures, there are different perspectives, it shouldn't be that way, but that is the set of mind. So here I come with a proposal for a law that distinguishes clearly between withholding and withdrawing, whereas in the United States, it's one and the same. Ethically, it's acceptable as being the same. So if you don't insert a tube of a respirator to a patient in certain circumstances, you're allowed to withhold it, not to insert it. But once you insert it, to withdraw it is an act that shortens life, and that is not permissible by Israeli law. So when I came to the Knesset proposing this, we had many debates. One of the members of the Knesset said, why do you suggest such a distinction here in the United States, that the most important democracy in the world, they don't distinguish between it. Why should we do it? So I told her, you know what? To pull the plug, you don't need an MD. Just pull the plug. So I invite you to come to Shaare Tzedek every morning, come to the intensive care, and pull the plugs and let the people die. So she said, what, I should do it? How will I sleep at night? So for her, it was difficult to do, but I should do it because in America, they do it. So that was the way people looked at it there. Here it is. Okay. So here's the dilemma. What do you do in end-of-life situations? So what I would suggest to you is that the dilemma is not primarily, or probably not at all, a medical or scientific question, but rather an ethical, legal, and so on. In other words, if you have a dying patient, you can intubate him, you can put a peg into him, and you cannot intubate him and not put a peg into him. So the medical issue, the pure medical issue, is available, but as a physician, we don't know what to do with it. The question whether to intubate, whether to sedate, whether to put a peg, is not a medical question, not at all. It is an ethical question, a legal question. In other words, it's a social question. If we as a society decide that everyone has to be intubated, then from a medical point of view, you can intubate everyone. If we as a society decide that we are not intubating anyone, so we won't use this technique that we have. So it's not a medical question, and therefore, the final decision, whether as a policy or in individual cases, should not be done by the physician as a physician. His expertise is irrelevant to the question here, because it's available, it can be done. The question whether it should be done is a social question and not a medical question. Now, just to give you a small background, in Holland, as I said, active euthanasia is legal. Not only is active euthanasia legal, but infanticide is also practiced in the Netherlands. Now if this is not a slippery slope, I don't know what a slippery slope is. Because the idea of active euthanasia makes a lot of sense from an autonomy point of view. For instance, in the United States, at the moment at least, active euthanasia is forbidden in all states. Physician-assisted suicide is permissible in a few states. Withholding treatment, even if it leads to death, is permissible in all states. Why is this distinction? Where does it come from? If you go by autonomy, and the autonomous patient says, the patient that went to Switzerland, if he says, I want to die now, this is my autonomous wish, why don't you kill him? Who are you to deny his autonomous wishes? And if you say, I deny it, why? Because my concepts, my conscience, my philosophy doesn't allow it, so where do you draw the line? Why active euthanasia, no, and physician-assisted, yes? Why physician-assisted, no, and withdrawing, yes? Where do you draw the line? And if you go by the Dutch theory, the Dutch say, if we respect autonomy, then active euthanasia should be practiced, because this is what the autonomous patient wants. However, if they practice it on infants, where's the autonomy here? The infant certainly doesn't ask to be killed. You can't ask him. So if you kill the infant, it shows really that the reason to kill or to euthanize people is not so much autonomy as it is my perspective of what is worth living. And then really you fall into a significant slippery slope, because I can say that an IQ less than 30 is not worth living, and someone will say an IQ less than 100 is not worth living. And where do you draw the line there? So I think that is a very difficult issue, and in fact, most studies from Holland have shown that they practice active euthanasia against their own rules and regulations. Once they got used to it, as I told you earlier, it's easy to do it, so they do it. Now, in Oregon and now in several other states, active euthanasia is not permissible, but physician-assisted suicide is permissible. And as I said, most Western countries hold that withdrawing of respirator and withholding food and fluid are all permissible. All these are halakhically unacceptable. Now, to analyze the question, what are you allowed to do in end of life, you really have to balance between autonomy and the value of life. Now, I find it very problematic in the modern medical ethics of the United States and of many Western countries. They all go by the Georgetown mantra of the four principles. The four principles being autonomy, beneficence, non-maleficence, and justice. Where is life or value of life in this mantra? So you may say they forgot it. They just forgot to mention it. I think that they omitted it in purpose. There is no more value to life per se. It is only life as described by the person, or if it's beneficial, or if it's justice, but life per se has lost its ethical dimension. And I think that is very problematic from an ethical point of view, and certainly unacceptable from a halakhic point of view. Now, certainly in halakha, the value of life, or what we would call the sanctity of life, is the most important value, because all values serve life. Otherwise, we don't need values. We need the values because we want to serve life. The question among the poskim, especially the modern ones that had to deal with the modern issues of end of life, is the value of life of infinite value, or is it a very important one, but still relative to situations? Now, there are a few of the poskim, including Waldenberg, which I'll mention in a minute, and I'll tell you a little story of an encounter with him. A minority holds that the value of life is of infinite value. Now, if you say in philosophy that something is infinite, it means that there are no exceptions. Because once you make the slightest exception, then it becomes relative to this exception. So therefore, if you hold that life is of infinite value, then you have to treat with all available treatments at a time, every patient, every minute of life, no matter how costly it is, no matter how pain and suffering it introduces, and no matter what he himself wants. because the value of life is of infinite value. Now, most current poskim hold that the value of life is extremely important, but not an absolute value. And in fact, it is very difficult to understand from a halachic perspective the opinion that it is halachically of infinite extent. And I don't have the time now to prove to you from sources that indeed there are exceptions to the value of life, and once there are exceptions, it is not of infinite extent. So it is an extremely important value, but not an absolute value. Therefore, we are not allowed ever to hasten death, but we are not required always to prolong life. That is the difference between extremely important and absolute. So that there are exceptions to this rule. Now I'm coming to this Israeli law that I told you earlier. And it's a huge law. It has many, over 150 paragraphs. It's very detailed and very big. But related to palliative care, we introduced in the law two paragraphs that we were the first in the world to do it. I think by now only France has adopted the same position, which says that a responsible physician must make sure that every possible thing is done in order to alleviate pain and suffering of a dying patient, even if this presents a risk of death, including by means of medications and so on, and environmental means, all according to the appropriate principles of palliative care and in accordance with the current conditions and arrangements of the healthcare system. Now, this is the only law in the world that requires by law palliative care. In all other countries, palliative care has become a good practice of medicine, a good standard of medicine, but it is not legally binding. If you have a patient in the United States or in Canada in a hospital and you don't provide palliative care, you don't go against any law. There's no law that forces you to give palliative care. The Israeli law forces the issue of palliative care, and as you see, it says according to appropriate principles of palliative care, which means that it can be updated periodically according to what palliative care experts say is the right treatment. And even if this presents a risk of death, and I'll come to it in a minute. So I think we were really pioneers in the world in enacting a binding law to this situation. Now, an anecdote. The Minister of Health, when I presented to him, this is already the law, but before that was a draft of legislation that we presented, and this was in it. When I presented it to the Minister of Health, he accepted the entire law except for this paragraph. The reason being that it will cost him money. Because this is the only money issue in the law. I mean, if you say treat him that way, or don't treat him, okay, so these are rules and regulations. But if you have to provide palliative care, you need a position of a physician of palliative care, you need teaching of palliative care, all this involves money. And he didn't want to spend money. He was forced to enact it because the Knesset found it an important part of the law, and therefore it entered into the law. Moreover, in the same law, a responsible physician must make sure that every possible thing is done in order to alleviate burden on family members of a dying patient, and to care for their well-being while the patient is in the medical institution. In other words, the palliative care is a holistic care. It is not only the patient himself, because his family are patients the same way as he is. They are all enclosed in the same circle. Some of them can't go to work because they take care of their patient. Some of them have psychological problems with the circumstances, and other issues that social medicine has to take into account to provide for the family. So this particular law provides a must of palliative care both to the patient and to his family. Now, this is based on a halachic perspective. And the halachic perspective is that palliative care is permissible even if might hasten death, because the concept is that terminal pain is an illness for which reasonable medical risks are permissible. Now, there are struggles in the world, even in the palliative care societies, how to justify the treatment of palliation in end of life when it can lead to death. Indeed, we know, as was shown by Dr. Berger and Dr. Abrams, that palliative care, in fact, increases longevity of life. But we are talking here at a time when this wasn't known so well, and the understanding, perhaps today, the myth was that palliative care, especially painkillers, are shortening life. So if it's shortening life, how can we permit to do it? And the answer is, that was the concept of a Shlomo Zalman Neuerbach that I think is the best that I heard to explain the concept in an ethical and certainly halachic way. And this is the following. If someone has a brain tumor, what do you do for him? You take him to the OR, you operate his brain tumor, and you hope to save his life. But a certain percentage will die on the table. So you're hastening death of a person that without your intervention would have lived longer. Because you intervened, he died earlier. But because this is the standard care, and the standard care implies risks, as long as they are reasonable according to the circumstances, that particular treatment is not only permissible, but is mandated halakhically. You have to take this risk because you have greater chances to survive. When you talk about a terminally ill patient, pain and suffering is the brain tumor. This is his illness at the moment. Nothing else counts. You can't do anything about any other aspects of his disease. The only disease is pain. We are not used to term pain as an independent disease. But that is a mistake. This is the independent, only important disease that this patient has. How do you treat this disease? You don't take him to the OR, you give him morphine. Morphine is treating the illness that is called pain that requires this treatment, even though a certain percentage may die of it as a side effect. The same as any other illness that you treat, any other serious illness that you treat, and has a side effect that may even kill it. So therefore, even if it will lead to kill the patient, as long as the intention is to treat it, this disease, which is called pain, and in the majority of the cases, it is not killing the patient, death is permissible and probably even required halakhically. With the new studies, we know that the percentage of hastening death is really negligible, even less than a brain tumor operation. Therefore, it is permissible to take this way of treatment in this particular situation. And just to show you that it's not a new question, there is a respondent in the Sicily that I asked him this question. I asked him in Tafshin Lamed Zayin, which is 1977, so we are talking about more than 35 years ago. I was with a darker beard at the time. And I asked him, and he writes, לכבוד מכובדיה, רופא התורני, blah, blah, blah. השאלה היא, הדבר חולה מסוכן, הסובל מייסורים, a very sick patient who has significant suffering, and it is acceptable to give him morphine or other types of treatments, but they don't cure his disease, his basic disease, but they may hasten death. Are we permitted to do it? So he says that we are permitted to do it, and the line here, mutar latet chole, you're allowed to give it to the patient, even though they may harm and even hasten death, because this is what we are treating now at the moment. Now remember, Rabbi Wartenberg was of the opinion, of the minority opinion, that the value of life is of infinite value. Yet to treat this disease, he was willing to allow, even if it hastens death. Now if he allowed it, certainly Rav Auerbach, who did not hold that life is of infinite value, it's very important, but not of infinite value, he writes the same thing, that you're allowed to give morphine to a dying patient, even if it may hasten death, provided, he added a provision, provided the aim of the treatment is only to relieve pain and suffering, and not to kill, because the fear of many of the rabbis was that the palliative people will say, we are giving him 20 milligrams of morphine just to relieve his pain, which is clear that 20 milligrams of morphine is really intended to kill him. You don't need 20 milligrams of morphine. But you say you do it only to relieve his pain. So this is a prerequisite, that you really treat him to relieve pain, and that not each individual injection will be the one that will kill the patient. So the 70 minutes that you mentioned, according to Rav Auerbach, would be right to give this medication. Because if he would die instantly, that would be wrong, because this is an act of killing. Now, how would you know it or not? Maybe we'll have time to go into it, but the principle is that we are treating a disease which is called pain. Our aim is to treat and not to kill, and the treatment is not necessarily immediately killing the patient. If these three conditions are met, that is acceptable halakhically. So, in essence, he agreed that you should give him this treatment. The same is Moshe Feinstein also has a responsum that allows to give it. In fact, I don't know any of the poskim who understand halacha in the right way that would disagree for palliative care done in the palliative way and not as euthanasia. That is an important distinction. So to sum up, what we are talking about is that if you treat a patient, you can do it in three ways. Either you give him everything, and I put it in parentheses because no one can treat with everything every patient. You don't do a heart transplant to someone who's dying of cancer anyway momentarily. But everything meaning the usual treatment that will prolong life with a day, with 2 days, or whatever, based on the concept that value of life is of absolute value. The opposite of it is active euthanasia, which is direct, intentional killing of a patient upon his request, although, as we saw, there is a deviation from this request, and that is based on the value of autonomy being an overriding value, taking over even the value of life, or omitting totally the value of life, and therefore you can kill the patient. And there is an in-between between the two extremes. It was used to call passive euthanasia. I don't think it has any meaning to call it passive. You do something, and even if you don't do, it's also an active decision not to do. So it is a way of shortening life, but it balances between the value of life and autonomy and quality of life, so that certain acts are permissible and others are not. And the rules of what yes and what not are basically those rules here, although obviously in real life there are a lot of nuances that have to be taken into account. So on the one hand, in halacha we distinguish between omission and commission. In other words, an act done which has the purpose of hastening death is euthanasia. Doesn't matter if you inject morphine in a 20 milligram dose or more, or whether you withdraw a respirator from a respirator dependent patient that will die after you withdrew the respirator, or if you have a pacemaker, withdrawing the pacemaker so that the patient will die instantly. That is an act, and an act is forbidden by Jewish law. But omission is permissible, because omission is not an act of killing. What we transgress by omission is a different biblical rule, which is called Lo Tamod Al Dam Re'echa. You shouldn't stand idle by your fellow man. And if I can save his life and I'm not saving his life, I am standing idle before him. But in this situation, where he's dying anyway, according to most, except for the few that I said earlier, this does not apply. And therefore, if I'm not doing anything, I'm not violating anything. And therefore, that is permissible. Now, we also distinguish between continuous and cyclic treatments, where continuous treatment, as an example, is a pacemaker or a respirator, and a cyclic treatment is dialysis or chemotherapy. Just to exemplify, if you put someone on dialysis, each cycle, by definition, is limited. You put him for 4 hours on Sunday, you remove the respirator as part of the treatment, and you call him back on Tuesday. And he comes back on Tuesday. Now, medically, perhaps, people view the order for dialysis as a continuous treatment. But halakhically, each cycle is a new decision. So if you try dialysis, and it doesn't work, and the patient continues to deteriorate, and he suffers, you can withhold the next cycle. You don't withdraw anything because you didn't put him on it. Same holds true for chemotherapy. It comes every 10 days for a treatment, so the next time that it comes, you just don't give it to him. So that is called a cyclic treatment, that the withholding of the next cycle is permissible. In a pacemaker or respirator, you can't put him on a respirator, withdraw him, and tell him to come Tuesday back. He'll never come back, right? So that is a continuous form of treatment, and if you stop it, you did an act that hastened death, and therefore that is not permissible. And the third important distinction is between treatments pertaining to the fatal condition versus treatments pertaining to the mere fact that he's still alive. So if you have a cancer patient and you treat him with chemotherapy, there is a treatment related directly to his illness, of which he's going to die. And if you decided that he is going to die no matter what, so you can withhold this particular direct treatment. But what does food and fluid have to do with the fact that he has cancer? I don't have cancer, Baruch Hashem, but I need food and fluid. So as long as he's alive, he needs food and fluid. That is something that is a sustenance of life pertaining to the fact that he's still alive, not to do at all with the fact that he's dying. So therefore, food and fluid basically has to be provided to everyone, unless food or fluid cause complications. Then it becomes a medical decision whether you should provide food and fluid or not, based on the fact that food and fluid in this particular moment in time will complicate matters. And all studies, I think, are fault by the fact that people confuse ethics with facts. People who feel that it's better for the patient to die, and therefore why prolong his life by food and fluid, confuse it with saying that medically it is not indicated. That is not the case. In most instances, in some instances, it is true that over fluid can cause edema, can cause lung edema, and obviously it complicates matters. Food sometimes can cause discomfort and so on. These are medical questions. But if medically there is no contraindication to food and fluid, that has to be provided because it has nothing to do with the fact that he's dying. It has to do with the fact that he's still alive, that he's a human being that lives and needs sustenance. That is the halakhic concept. Again, it's very different than some of the ethical considerations in this area here in the United States. There are countries which accept this policy, there are countries which don't, but halakhically, that is the principle. So, if you look at these parameters, the blue and the green, The blue has to be provided no matter what, unless it complicates matters. The green can be withheld or withdrawn if it is a cyclic treatment, because by halakhic definition it is also called withholding, except for those that you need to withdraw as a medical withdrawal, and that would not be permissible, but withholding certainly would be permissible. So in summary, from a halakhic point of view, active euthanasia is absolutely forbidden, physician-assisted suicide is absolutely forbidden, withdrawal of continuous treatment is absolutely forbidden, all the rest is permissible. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Robert Steinberg. If I can ask the speakers perhaps to come here. We have about 30 minutes now, and I'm sure there's lots of questions here. So again, it's 1 o'clock, lots of time. I'll just have, please just direct your speaker. You can direct it to anybody in particular. I saw Warren's hand first.
Can I make
your
comments? Yeah.
Sure.
Oh. Over here?
Oh,
no, just from
here. Yeah, from there. I got
so, I actually think the gap should distinguish between palliative care and end-of-life care. I think palliative care is from diagnosis. I mean, a person with diabetes is getting palliative care. They're getting management of their symptoms, trying to reduce their complications. They may not be dying. End of life care is, I think, a more apropos discussion about what we actually provide. So palliative care is not, I guess, the bad thing. I think it's really how you provide end of life care. I think that's, and I would say I'm a palliative care physician, but I provide end of life care. And a person with breast cancer who can live for 20 years shouldn't have palliative care from day one when they start with their treatment or their making decisions to make, give them the best quality of life. Or I have a long way to go. So that was just something. And palliative care is not about killing patients. And palliative care, actually, the Canadian Hospice and Palliative Care Association came out with a very strong statement when Bill 52 was presented and said, this is not something that should be under the purview of palliative care physicians. So if you think that the palliative care physicians are the doctors that are going to go and do Bill 52, that is an unrealistic expectation. So who's going to do it remains to be seen. Palliative care is about providing comfort to their patients. It's not about killing patients. So, anyway.
Okay. Warren.
Yeah. I thought all three presentations were fantastic. Dr. Berger Bryant, I know you weren't saying the ICU in those two first pictures, present the bedside with everyone around and the other one in the ICU, but just about that death with dignity thing that I remember. Kendler saying, that could be the most dignified death with all the greatest machinery and science doing everything to try to save you and you die anyway. So I think I just wanted to bring up that point too. I know you weren't making the opposite point, but I just think it's an important point to make.
Yeah, I was obviously indicating there's something in the middle ground.
Right. Yeah.
I also think for some people, dying like that in an ICU is what they want, what they expect, and is a very appropriate decision. Dying at home is not for everybody.
Yeah. Since you mentioned the concept of dying with dignity, I think we should stay away from misnomers. Many people coin a phrase and they think by that they satisfy the ethical dimensions. So if you say in Holland you're dying with dignity because I'm killing you, so that is okay, because I said that is death with dignity. So I think we should stay away from all these terminologies which are so subjective, and everyone sees dignity in a different way, and it doesn't mean that the physician is ill-meaning, but it doesn't mean that he understands what is dignity for another person. So I think that all these misnomers, there are a lot of those, I guess, through the discussion will go over, but since you mentioned that the dignity, I'm trying to stay away from this council.
So I have a question for Rabbi Dr. Steinberg. So I'm probably going to use the word slippery slope in a way you haven't heard it before, but when you showed the laws in Israel and you showed that a physician must do everything to help the patient and make them comfortable and must do everything to comfort the family, this frightened me that, you know, that there's laws that are going to make it that I, let's say, a surgeon with, it's, you know, at the comfort of family who's having an appendectomy, and if he doesn't, it's a criminal offense, you know, like a law that makes a physician must. That's what I was concerned about.
Well, I think the law says specifically that it is in accordance with the standards of palliative care. This is a medical field. The law doesn't tell you how to do it. It doesn't tell you give midazolam 2 milligram or give morphine 5 milligram. It only tells you you must, in other words, the frame of mind today, up to today, was that the physician is there to cure. And what the law wants to tell you is that in end-of-life situation, it is to care, as we heard earlier. And that is a change in the frame of mind of physicians, which I think is very important to put it into the law, to make it mandatory, that you should know that in end-of-life situations, the importance is to take care of pain and suffering. That is what is important there. Less important, the curing, because you can't cure by definition. If it is an end of life according to the Israeli law, which is someone who has an incurable disease and is within the last 6 months expected to live. That is the definition of a dying patient. So in this situation, where by definition it's a fatal incurable disease, and it's so advanced that he's going to die within a few months, what is left is palliative care. And the law wants to make sure that you do it. And there's no other way to do it, because I know from experience, as a pediatric urologist, when a kid comes at 2 a.m. with seizures, he right away called me, what should we do? But if he's screaming his head off because he has pain, they say, wait for the morning and someone will see you, right? That's how we practice, and I think that's wrong.
Okay.
I have two questions from Steinberg. The first question is, I'm an infectious disease physician, and I'm soaked out of referral antibiotics, so if I'm asked by the family to stop the antibiotics and clear life-threatening infection count, that's the first question. Second question is, it seems that the opinion of the post-im, I work in a hospital with a very active palliative care team that pulls patients off with ventilators. So if according to the post-im, the decision to give pain management is based upon the intent is to cure the illness of pain rather than the patient's death. But if you have a palliative care team that has a sort of chazaka, that it's clear that they don't value life, and they already have a record of pulling patients off of ventilators, so it's clear that their intent in general, that their value system is to end life earlier, so how do you trust such people to administer pain medication with the proper intention to deal with the pain and not the symptom? Yeah.
I don't think that's a fair judgment as a palliative care team pulling them off. I don't think they're not valuing life. That's not your question, so I let him address the question, but I don't think that's fair to say that of the palliative care team. I mean,
Sandra made it said clearly that it's halakhically not permitted.
I'm not saying it's halakhically permitted either, right? But I'm not. But I think that they're not, but they don't value life in that patient.
So on your first question about antibiotics, that is a borderline situation. What most poskim say, and their reasoning is, that first degree, second degree antibiotics you give because it's still part of the person being alive, and you treat something which can be treatable within the untreatable condition. In other words, if someone is going to die from cancer in 6 months, and he has now a pneumococcal pneumonia, that you can give him penicillin and it will cure the pneumonia now, although he'll die in 6 months anyway, he shouldn't die now from something which is curable within the uncurable situation.
Are you obligated to give?
Yeah.
You're obligated.
Obligated to give antibiotics. No, you're obligated. In other words, you shouldn't let a patient die of something which is treatable within the process of dying. On the other hand, if he gets an overwhelming sepsis and you can't even isolate what bacteria it is, what sensitivity, and you give broad spectrum antibiotics and you throw one after the other, that you're not obligated to do, because now again the fatal illness now is his sepsis. Even though he will die from his cancer in 6 months, he will die from his sepsis now, and it's incurable. Although you can try to give antibiotics. So that is a distinction that is being made as far as antibiotics are concerned. So we at the Charlotte we treat with simple infectious diseases with simple antibiotics, but once it becomes an overwhelming sepsis and, and you run after one after the other antibiotic, we stop at a certain point. Now, as far as trusting the palliative team, I think it's a matter of process. And most rabbis are conservative, and they work with experience. I think the initial palliative movement was really to remove everything, to stop food and fluid, to stop all the respirators, to withdraw everything, and let the patient really die with some comfort, which was an addition. I think today the concept is the opposite. Once a decision was made that he will not be put on a respirator, we are now treating his pain and suffering. And that, I think, is a major change in the concept, at least the way we see it in Israel now, and that is certainly permissible. So if you go to a hospice that doesn't provide food and fluid, or takes away continuous treatment while they are on it, that the rabbis are opposed to. But if a decision was made already in the hospital that he is a DNR in the sense that he will not be intubated, he will be withheld from intubation, and now he is suffering, that all these postings that I quoted are very much for the treatment.
Okay. I see lots of hands, and if I could just ask be brief with your questions, and the same would be true for the respondents, because there's a lot of people here, I thought.
Professor Steinberg, was it halakhically acceptable to take off the BiPAP from the ALS patient? How is that different from extubating him? Because it clearly hastens his death. Secondly, the issue of terminal extubation is not black and white. There are times a patient's taken off a ventilator, their life will be shortened, but they may live for 2 weeks. And with the ventilator, they would have lived for 6 months or something. So where do you draw the line?
It's easier for me to answer the second question if I understood it. There are two ways to withdraw from a ventilator. One way is to withdraw because I want the patient to die. It's not stated in these words, but we decided that he is already a DNR patient and he doesn't want to live, he has a living will, and he was intubated for a period of time. Now we decided that that's it. We withdraw it with the intention that knowing that he can't, he's respirator dependent, knowing that he needs a respirator, yet we discontinue it. That is not permissible. But if you withdraw a respirator as a medical process, he is getting a little better, and as a medical situation, you are withdrawing gradually the respirator, and you're keeping him now without a respirator. If right away you see that he is failing, then you have to reintubate. But if he holds out for 2 weeks, in your example, then when he fails, it's a new decision. Do you have to put him on a respirator or not? And now it is a decision of withholding, not withdrawing, because you withdrew it as a medical process, hoping that he will be okay without the respirator. So it's an important distinction which we make all the time. I mean, in practice, that's how we try to do it. Now, about the BiPAP, I'm not clear, maybe I lack medical knowledge on this issue, but why do we need to discontinue the BiPAP? What do I care if he's on a BiPAP, but comfortable? He gets midazolam, he gets morphine, he's quiet, he's well, and he gets his BiPAP. And he can live longer in this situation. Why not? So maybe there's an answer to that.
Yeah, well, obviously in that situation, the BiPAP was a physical apparatus that was present that was not allowing him to have the comforts with his wife especially and his children as well, to hold him, to love him, to kiss him, to be with him, and to say the appropriate goodbyes. It was a barrier in that situation that was an obstruction that was having a very negative aspect of this dying person. Besides the fact that, and he said, I want to talk, so obviously that's the situation. As you say, I don't know if a rabbi was not involved in that process, he didn't ask for one, although there were one or two religious brothers that were make any negative comment about that process. but I did feel at the time is it life I'm extubating? The surprise for me was that what made it more comforting in terms of not what appeared to be an active euthanasia process was that he survived for 70 minutes, so it was a total unexpected time. But a lot of that may be part of the study of comfort with midazolam, hydromorphone at the time, in constant small infusions. I mean, not like massive whopping doses, but small doses of a milligram, 0.5 milligrams every 10, 15 minutes whenever you needed it, which sort of what it does really, in retrospect, in thinking about it, is just suppress your feelings of breathlessness, your feelings of agitation, and therefore almost work like the BiPAP for him in terms of it was that way of keeping him comfortable versus the BiPAP.
Okay.
We move forward. Well, two comments like that.
Okay. You heard it. Don't come back later.
Just two comments from that. I'm not sure that the added comfort of the family being able to have a direct contact with him and the BiPAP intervening is as important as keeping him alive another day or two. I'm not so sure. And secondly, the whole idea of giving him small doses is to keep him calm, and if you keep the BiPAP, he doesn't suffer from it. He doesn't suffer. Now, perhaps the family would feel better the contact, but that is not enough of a reason to let him die early. Now, the other problem is that at the time that you withdrew the BiPAP, you didn't know that he'll survive 70 minutes. He could have died instantaneously. And that is exactly what we are afraid of by doing an act that kills the patient right away, and you couldn't know it ahead of time. So therefore, I personally feel that I would keep the BiPAP and keep him comfortable. I don't see
why. Do his wishes count?
Now, his wishes count to a certain degree. Autonomy in Jewish law, and I don't know if Dr. Friedman won't let me talk.
Oh, no. You guys are giving me a bad rap. Come on. I'm hiding in this box.
It's a whole discussion on what is autonomy in Jewish law, but it's certainly not as important as it is in current secular ethics in the United States. So autonomy counts, for instance, to withhold treatment. If he asked to withhold treatment, we would respect it in end-of-life situation. But to kill him, if he would say, kill me, I want to go to Switzerland and kill me, that we're not allowed, even if we would respect autonomy. So therefore, if this would be an act of killing, I'm not saying it was, but assuming that it was an act of killing, the autonomous wish would not have come.
Steinberg, I have a question about food and fluids. Just to make a distinction, so a person stops eating and stops drinking, are you then obligated to put in an NG tube or an IV? That is something that we are actually actively doing and perhaps interfering with what might be a normal death process, etc. And if that is so, if you say yes, I don't know which way you're going to say, then we should really have to transfuse patients, etc., because as we let patients' hemoglobin go down to a certain point, they will certainly, they will die eventually from severe anemia.
So again,
5 grams
would
go down to
1 or 2 grams. Yeah, so again, there's a difference between the way the thinking process in the United States and the halakhic thinking. And sometimes I find it difficult to speak to an American audience because you are so cultivated into this notion that you can't think differently. But that is new, even in the United States. It's a matter of 20, 30 years that withdrawing of food and fluid is an accepted ethical and legal way of treating end-of-life situations. It wasn't so even in America 30, 40 years ago. And it's not so in Jewish law even today. So
So the Jewish law, to summarize it in just a few words, is that if a person is a goyses, which by halakhic definition is someone who's going to die within 2 or 3 days, then you can withhold food and fluid. So if it is an immediate dying patient, you don't have to give any food and fluid. If he is to live longer than that, then you have to provide food and fluid by all available means, which are safe, and I'll say a minute how, provided it doesn't complicate the situation, as I said earlier. Now, if the intent is, like it is today, to stop food and fluid, so there are two controversial approaches. One approach says that it doesn't affect life and death anyway, so why give it? Another approach says, we want him anyway to die, so why prolong his living by food and fluid, which is contradictory. Either it helps or it doesn't help. So I think what really is known, at least medically, is that 3 days of dehydration kill patients. So hydration for longer than 3 days is the cause of death. So if your patient is to live, by your expectation, 6 weeks, 8 weeks, 6 months, or whatever, and you stop fluid, he will die sooner of dehydration. That there are clear evidence to that. Starvation, by many studies, show that it takes over 2 weeks to die of starvation. So if your patient is going to die within 2 weeks and you stop food, then you didn't hasten death, because this would not be the cause of his death. But if he is to live 6 months and you stop feeding him, he will certainly die of starvation. There's no logic to say that it doesn't hasten death. No one can live so long without food and fluid. So therefore, it depends what the prognosis of the patient is. If it's very short, you can stop everything. If it's short, you can stop food. If it's longer, you have to provide both. Now what we do, at least I do it with my, I am a pediatric neurologist, but I take care of degenerative diseases that children die. I put a peg very early in the illness, and the peg is there at the time where it is safe to put it in, the patient is still fine, and I'm not using the peg. I'm feeding it by mouth. When the time comes that he can't get food by mouth, he has an open venue that I can feed him very comfortably, both for the team and for the patient, unless there are complications of the particular food that is being given to him. And I think that is a way that does justice both with the halakhic point of view and with the ethical point of view, if you do it that way.
Are we saying, therefore, that patients who have cancer at the beginning of their diagnosis, that we should put it back?
Well,
it
depends how beginning. I mean, I'm not saying that the first day that you diagnosed him and he has you saw the first malignant melanoma and he can live another 20 years, you don't put a peg now. But I'm talking about a situation where he is deteriorating, but he's still well enough to tolerate a peg, and then why not feed him? What's wrong with feeding him?
And if they refuse?
Well, I'm not talking about autonomy and about the Lord in America and so on. I'm talking the halakhic point of view.
If I was in Israel,
if you were in Israel, then he would be forced to.
I would be forced to.
You would be forced to do it by law. Now, there is an exception halakhic opinion, and that is what Moshe Feinstein's opinion, that if the patient is competent and refuses food, you shouldn't force it on him. Because in his opinion, that will worsen his condition. Psychologically, it may worsen. I don't know on what studies it's based. That was his opinion.
Western culture,
maybe. But most of the other post-team disagreed with him, and he will certainly die of starvation, and whether he will die because you forced him of psychological discomfort is not so clear, and therefore that's the preferred way.
Sorry, I just want to say, when you mentioned that you mentioned earlier about the rabbi getting involved, I mean, as you say, from a distance, they're getting involved, something you mentioned earlier. And I mean, clearly that's an issue for a lot of us in palliative care, with all chaplain services. I mean, people with different religions where that happens. From a rabbinical point of view, I mean, the difficulty from rabbis being certainly distance makes it very difficult. They're not assessing the patient, they're not seeing the patient, and they have no involvement with the whole situation. And the difficulty there is that they give family advice without having any knowledge about what's going on. And many of us within the palliative care work have been spending hours with families dealing with situations. We've got them to a certain point, and that can sometimes be very negative against it. When suddenly they say, the rabbi said that you should be using an IV in a setting and all that sort of thing. When we've gone through all the problems that happened already with an IV in that circumstance. And that's people. If, however, sometimes a rabbi does come in, that's a different story, and gets involved, that makes it much more appropriate. The problem is it depends which rabbi comes in and what their experience is. And I personally find, I'm not a very any very religious Orthodox sect, but I find sometimes what happens is certain rabbis who may be younger, I'm going to say the Lubavitch rabbis that have come aboard are used to a young community, etc., may not be used to seeing, in my experience, death and dying to that degree. They sometimes see a member of their community that they haven't maybe seen for 2 or 3 months. They come to the hospital and they see a cachectic, very terminal patient. And for them, it has a certain level of discomfort. So what do? They automatically cling to what their level of comfort is, which is, where's the oxygen, where's the IV, what's happening with the food, as opposed to, are you all right, can we say a prayer, can we be together? And so it really does depend on the rabbi's influence, like what his own personal feeling is about mortality, his education, his experience with it. I've had some very positive responses, and issues have really become very negative, even with their presence there. But I find the worst is if they haven't been there and people are asking for advice.
I can just comment. This is my question from before.
Yeah.
That I've had exactly that circumstance happen, where I've had a family that wants to do everything halakhically correct, and they'll have a couple of kids, one of whom has a major problem. And I had a situation where I had a lady with end-stage lung disease, end-stage heart disease. She had been extubated. She had already had a defibrillator in. She had everything that you can conceive of. And they insisted, based on some rabbi that they had spoken to who hadn't seen the patient, that the patient had CTR, that should not be allowed to die without that, which to me was an absolute assault upon this patient who weighed about 75 pounds, where they were going to actually break her wrist. And
is that any different to a doctor consultant without full information?
Unfortunately, I've run up against the situation many times. I have another person, a relative of mine, that they got a stop from somebody in Toronto, actually, who had said that this lady who was end stage, who had been transferred from Columbia to a hospital somewhere else because she was ready to die, she was unresponsive, she lost a tremendous amount of weight, and they got stuck a lot of it. They had to do CPR with her 3 consecutive times until they were convinced that she was dead before that they would let her die. And to me, that's an assault on a dose base, and that's not...
You have different doctors, you have different rabbis, and I think that's what I've learned to respect. I mean, you're going to have people coming from a whole lot of different backgrounds, with different educational things, and although, I mean, it's nice now, for example, thank you very much, I can quote some of what you have indicated, but I mean, not every rabbi would go by their doctor.
Well, no one hears right now what I'm saying, right? It's a secret. I think that there are many rabbis who don't understand the issue, not only from a medical point of view, but also from a halachic point of view. And that's a problem. And we encounter it, unfortunately. Like many other advisors, there are lawyers who give advice and they don't know the doctors. There are all kinds. So there are all kinds of problems. However, having said that, I think it's important to understand two basic issues. One is that there are rabbis who hold that the value of life is infinite. So therefore, they don't need to see the patient. It doesn't matter how the patient looks and what he feels and what he wants. Halakhically, according to them, and that is certainly a legitimate position, halakhically, you have to do everything. So if she is 80 years old or 90 years old, and you have to break her cage or not, doesn't matter. You have to do everything to prolong every minute of life. That is a concept. So that you can't blame, quote-unquote, those particular rabbis who know. I'm talking about those
who rule that way, but they don't know why they rule it. They rule it because they heard it or they're afraid or whatever. But I'm talking about serious rabbis, including, for instance, Rav Eliashiv, I mentioned earlier, this is your site tomorrow, the first your site. He held that everything has to be done to prolong every minute of life, including his own life. He suffered terribly at the end, and he got all the treatments because this was his position. So that is a legitimate position. Now, there are many rabbis, especially Moshe Feinstein and Avshalom Zalman Auerbach, who held differently. According to them, they have to see the patient or at least get a medical information correctly. And personally, I can witness that Avshalom Zalman Auerbach, whenever there was a case that he was consulted, he used to call up the doctor of the patient, get the full information, and sometimes would call up a senior doctor, even if he's not the doctor of this particular patient, to get a better understanding. And I think this is the right way to rule on these issues.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's 1:33. If you wish this session to continue, show me a raise by some vote. I want this to be democratic. Others, it's 1:30. We've already gone over by 10 minutes.
Tomorrow afternoon, I'm sure it's during our question and answer period.
Fair enough. I think that's a reasonable thing. Thank you very much. I'd like to thank our speakers.